I'm Nahla Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The whole point of the audio experience, whether it's a radio show or a podcast, is to have sound. But our topic today is silence. More precisely, the downside of silence. Consider noise-canceling headphones. What they give you is simple enough, the ability to block out whatever sound is annoying you or distracting you out there in the world. What's less apparent is what they might be taking away.
I think we're in a crisis of listening right now. Listening has become very fraught for us acoustically. Right? There's been so many books in the new millennium about the loss of silence. One of the books was titled One Square Inch of Silence. I was like, man, that's desperate.
Mac Haygood is a scholar of sound. He says, don't get him wrong, he loves noise-canceling headphones. He uses them himself. But there is a subtle shift in the way you think about the noise of life all around you when you can turn it off.
We've really become sort of like consumers of sound, rather than people who just simply experience the sounds around us. In my estimation, what these headphones really do is turn our world into a database of content that we can access selectively, decide whether we want it or not. And that can be a wonderful thing. I have noise-canceling headphones. I use them when I fly. But if we just reflexively always use that, I do think that there are opportunity costs in becoming consumers of sound rather than people who engage with our world sonically.
Mac Haygood coming up. Later this hour, meet a Buddhist monk who left his family in Canada at the age of 13 to study under a Zen master.
In Plum Village, Zen Master Tikihan teaches about engaged Buddhism, and mindfulness is the foundation. So I started to understand much more that Buddhism is not about worship. It's not about wishing for a better future or wishing for a pure land of the Buddha, which is equivalent to the kingdom of God in Christianity. But it's more about how do we take care of ourselves in the present moment.
Buddhist brother Phap Hu on life in Plum Village with his teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, a little later. We begin with the mixed blessing and deeper meaning of noise-canceling technology. Crank up those headphones. This is Tapestry. I'm Mary Hines. Maybe it's happened to you. You have your earbuds in, podcast on, or music cranked up. Someone you love dearly tries to talk to you, and you feel it, a burst of irritation. What is this interruption? I'm in the zone over here. Mac Haygood has felt that annoyance, and as someone who studies sound, he's really curious about what it means when your personal bubble is interrupted. Mac is assistant chair and associate professor of media and communication at Miami University, which is in the Miami Valley in Ohio. Hi, Mac.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. When did you have your first inkling that this impulse to screen out the noise that we don't like might be rewiring the way people operate out in the world?
Oh, boy. When did I first sense this? I mean, I think I sort of had an inkling that, you know, with any technology, there's always a downside to the sort of wonders that it gives us. I can just think of a recent example that sort of encapsulates that. My family and I were on a flight for the first time since the COVID shutdowns, and the Delta flight attendant walked around handing out earbuds. And since I'm a sound nerd and interested in this kind of thing, I asked for some. And I looked at the packaging, and it was really fascinating because I looked at the back of the packaging and it said, stay connected. And the back of the package really emphasized like all the connectivity that our devices offer us, right? Like Wi-Fi, movies, music, texting, all these. The normal way we think about communications devices, like they inform us, they entertain us, they help us communicate with other people, right? And I flipped over the package and looked at the front and it said, plug in, tune out. And I was like, this is the encapsulation of like what my research is all about, because our technologies don't just help us connect, right? That's the story we tell ourselves. But the technologies are also there to help us disconnect. The technologies are there to help us. Really, what we want is to be in control. We want control over our contact with the world and with others. And that is really what media do for us.
But I love that snapshot of, you know, here's your invitation to connect by shutting yourself down, right? Like shut out the whole world. Well, I'm glad you mentioned control. What do you think is lost when we try to exert that control, when we try to manage which sounds we will encounter and which sounds we do not want to be exposed to?
It's a great question. I think we're losing a lot. I think we're in a crisis of listening right now. Listening has become very fraught for us acoustically, right? There's been so many books in the new millennium about the loss of silence. One of the books was titled One Square Inch of Silence. I was like, man, that's desperate. Like, but
that is paltry, right? Yeah. That is really.
But, you know, there's other evidence out there, like noise complaints doubled in New York City in 1 5-year period recently. I remember when COVID happened and everyone stopped driving, people were like, why are the birds so loud? Like people were Googling, why are the birds so loud? Why are the birds so loud? I was like, the birds are the same volume they've always been. But we live in a really sort of world that's loud and makes listening difficult. But there are other kinds of effects, I think. And it's not just like acoustic. It's also political. You know, we have trouble listening to one another. The left accuses the right of always being in these right-wing echo chambers where they never have to hear about climate change or who actually won the United States election or what have you. The right accuses the left of having safe spaces and trigger warnings and preventing speakers from coming on college campuses. And I don't want to make any false equivalence between these sides, but I mean, everyone does seem to agree that something has gone wrong with listening.
And do you think that's tied to the technology that enables us to screen out so many sounds? Is there a correlation there in your view?
I do. Like what I do in my book is kind of use these acoustic technologies as a way to get us to reflect on what we're doing with all of our technologies. We're basically getting primed to think about listening as something that should always be a choice. We've really become sort of like consumers of sound rather than people who just simply experience the sounds around us. And so I think our technologies have really changed our listening in the sense that we interface with the sonic world around us. Your noise-canceling headphones, I don't know if you're familiar with how they work, but basically what they do is they have tiny microphones on the outside of the headphone and on the inside, and they're capturing the sounds of the world around you. And then they're playing those sounds back. So they're actually mediatizing the sounds, just like all the other mediated sounds you get. But they're playing them 180 degrees out of phase. So if you think about sound waves having crests and valleys, the crests and valleys cancel out.
Hence noise canceling. Now I'm getting it.
Yes, yes. And so in my estimation, what these headphones really do is turn our world into a database of content, just like content on the internet that we can access selectively and decide whether we want it or not. And that can be a wonderful thing. I have noise canceling headphones. I use them when I fly. But if we just reflexively always use that, I do think that there are opportunity costs in becoming consumers of sound rather than people who engage with our world sonically.
Picking up on that idea of engaging sonically, I'm curious about the moments of maybe serendipity or spontaneity. What can you see being sacrificed on that front?
Yes. Yeah. I do think there are all of these wonderful serendipitous things that could be happening for us, both sonically and socially, that we're not getting a chance to choose because we've already made this default choice to be plugged in with our headphones. And, you know, I don't want to over-dramatize this, but on the other hand, as a professor, you know, I've been teaching over 10 years now, and increasingly my students come into the classroom with their headphones on, and up until the class begins, some of them try to keep them in even after the class begins, unfortunately. That's a new trend. I don't know if I'm getting more boring or if something is changing socially. But and that is an opportunity right there where those students could be getting to know one another, and they're simply not. And I find that sad. Sometimes I think of it as a tragedy of the commons in reverse. Like, if I remember correctly, the tragedy of the commons is like, we have like a field of grass and we all want to feed our cows on it. But if we all try to feed our cows on it at the same time, then the grass gets eaten up and it's all gone. I think in this case, it's more like contribution. If no one is contributing to the social space around us, the social space gets more boring, less interesting, more sterile. And so there's even less reason to not be plugged into our technologies.
Mm. Well, then we can move right from the tragedy of the commons to the tragedy of Greek mythology, because I love it when someone brings the classics into the 21st century. And I know you've compared noise-canceling technology, noise-canceling headphones, to how Odysseus operated in Greek mythology. And so I am a little rusty. Take me through the story of the sirens again and that noise that would be disastrous.
Yeah. So the ancient Greeks give us this myth of the sirens, and the sirens were these bird-like women with these mesmerizing voices whose voices would lead you to their desolate island where you would meet certain death. A lot we can think about there, right? Like the sirens are exotic, right? They're unfamiliar. They're also women in a myth that's presumably written by male poets. And so there's this sort of otherness to them, right? This is kind of an othered sound that we feel like we don't want to integrate into ourselves, that we feel is dangerous. Odysseus was very clever and he wanted to hear the song without dying. So he had himself tied to the mast and he stuffed his sailor's ears with wax and they were able to go through the siren strait safely. But the person that I'm really find fascinating is Orpheus, because Orpheus actually met up with the sirens as well when he was traveling with Jason and the Argonauts. What Orpheus did was play his lyre and he sang his own countersong to fight the song of the sirens. And so in fighting sound with sound, he created this safe space that allowed he and the Argonauts to get away from the sirens safely. And that sort of crystallized, that myth sort of crystallized for me, like what I was fishing about for when I was studying these technologies for so long, like noise-canceling headphones and white noise machines and nature sound apps. There are all these sound-generating apps that we use to basically create a safe space through sound, the way that Orpheus did. So I call all of these things, I put them under the category I call Orphic media.
But in the myth, Orpheus and Odysseus are trying to avoid certain death, right? They don't want their ships to crash against the rock. So wasn't it imperative that they not listen? They had to avoid that music of the sirens at all costs?
Absolutely, they did. And I would say in our case too, there are very real reasons why people use these technologies. We live in, you know, an information economy where at least white-collar workers are pressed to be in complete control of their attention, right, so that they can be productive. But at the same time, that exact same attention economy creates, you know, this information economy creates all of these distractions that are always tempting us to do things other than be productive, right? And again, it's this sort of lossy way of being in the world where it's all just about rest or productivity. And that's when I studied these devices, that tended to be how people use them. The Bose noise-canceling headphone, well, it was first marketed to airline pilots so they could communicate with the air tower without the noise of the airplane. But when they turned it into a consumer device, Bose marketed it to this sort of upscale business class buyer so that they could be productive wherever they wanted to be. And that is precisely how it was marketed, through those kinds of images.
How have you found the marketing to change based on who's being targeted in that advertising?
Yeah, I mean, this was a fascinating thing that I learned from sort of looking at the advertising. You know, like the white noise machine that you might see in a therapist's hallway or something outside their office, this was originally marketed to sort of a white, middle-class, suburban American person who was maybe thought to be like a homemaker, right? And so that this white noise, they were trying to convince folks that it would make it better for your children to sleep and this sort of thing. So there was a sort of like gendered, I mean, I looked at all these ads and they were all these like white ladies sleeping next to this white noise machine. This was in the 1960s and 70s, when this thing started coming out. There was a series of records in the 1970s and 80s called Environments, and those were marketed more to sort of like a hippie generation, like countercultural generation. Like these records with ocean sounds and the sound of rain and this sort of thing, they're going to let you go on a mental trip. And they're going to make your plants grow faster, and they're going to enhance sex and all these kinds of things, which I kind of love that one, because it was a much more social marketing than you usually see for these kinds of orphic media. But then we get the noise-canceling headphones. I mean, it was almost all images of white, male, upper-class business travelers. And then we get, 10 years later, Beats by Dre, or Beats Electronic, and they market it to a much younger, more diverse demographic. And fascinatingly, a lot of the marketing that Beats has done around their headphones has been around sort of things like microaggressions. So it's noise from a sort of Black person's perspective. A lot of images of like athletes who are getting hounded by opposing teams, fans, or reporters asking sort of racially insensitive questions, and then like the athlete putting on the headphones and try to tune it all out.
A lot of this is evidently about control, that ability to carve out a space for yourself where you determine what sounds are allowed to enter, what sounds are not allowed to enter. Why would that aspect be cause for concern?
Yeah, so you know, we've talked a little bit about how this is just changing the nature of listening to turn it into more of like a consumer practice than just a way of engaging with one's environment. So I do think that that is a problem. We've also talked about the sort of opportunity cost of those happy accidents. But there's another aspect. When our listening gets constantly catered to, you know, where we can always just hear what we want, there's a way that this sort of perversely makes us more sensitized, and that we actually need more control. So the more control we have, it seems, the more control we need. We don't get the opportunity to practice listening across difference, you know, across social difference, for example. When it comes to just the acoustic surrounds, for example, look, I'll admit, I use a white noise machine so that I can sleep. I'm sensitive to sounds. I'm easily woken up, maybe because I'm such an audiophile. But now that I use the white noise machine, I really need the white noise machine, right? Because that has become my baseline. And we see this in conditions like hyperacusis, which is extreme sound sensitivity. This is a diagnosis in audiology that has really skyrocketed in recent years. And misophonia, which is like a sort of fear or hatred of certain sounds, particularly mouth sounds. And what folks with these kinds of conditions tend to do is wear earplugs to sort of protect their hearing, protect their ears. And it turns out that's the worst thing you can do, because the more you protect your hearing, the more sensitive it becomes. And so what they audiologists actually try to do with people is sort of give them a sort of exposure therapy, where they start taking the earplugs out and just engaging with the world as it is around them a little bit more. And I think about that, you know, as sort of a metaphor for what's happening to us politically, too. When you have the opportunity to go down whatever ideological rabbit hole is comfortable for you and never come back out of it, it just becomes harder to listen to someone else's point of view.
You're with Tapestry. Thanks for inviting us in, whether it's on podcast, on the CBC Listen app, or on CBC Radio 1. If you're listening online or on headphones at cbc.ca/tapestry, hello to you. I'm Mary Hines. My guest is the scholar of sound and noise canceling, Mac Haygood. Interested in aspects of this beyond the audiology, you know, beyond what's physically going on in the mind and in the ears. If I'm successful at screening out all of the noise I find annoying or distracting, does something happen when I am then confronted with a sound that I can't avoid? Does my tolerance just go down?
Yes, absolutely. I think it does. I find myself doing this sometimes when I'm listening to a podcast. I love podcasts like yours, and I've sometimes I'm really busy washing the dishes and listening to my podcast, and one of my kids tries to talk to me, and I get that twinge of annoyance, and I was like, oh my God, I study this stuff, and I'm still sort of being reactive in this way.
Well, that gets us into something, a phrase you've used, which is sonic spontaneity. You know, if we are able to cancel out some of the noise that serendipity sends our way, the noises our kids send our way, how do you think that might shape our relationship with other people?
Oh, I mean, it's hard to not just engage in cliches when we talk about listening and and the importance of listening in communication, right? But I do think that listening openly, not guarding our listening, is actually an opportunity to learn not only about the other, but also to learn about ourselves. Because when we hear a sound, we're not only hearing the sound out there, we're hearing our own perception and reaction to the sound. So hearing a sound that you don't like is actually sort of an opportunity to ask yourself, like, well, okay, what is the context that it's making this sound feel or sound unpleasant to me? What is it about my mindset that is making this sound feel so abrasive to me? The Zen teacher Shunryu Suzuki, he told a really fascinating story that I just love so much. He was trying to read a book while a blue jay was singing or squawking. I suppose he did not think that the blue jay had like the most melodious voice. And so he perceived it as noise. You know, he's like, I'm trying to read and that bird shouldn't be there. Like that's the perception of noise, right? But he said the challenge is actually to perceive the blue jay's voice as sound. And the way that he frames sound is that you hear it and you understand your own participation in it. I'm the blue jay singing and the bird is reading the book, is what he says.
Whoa.
Now, what exactly does that mean? I mean, it's one of those kind of Zen koans that can't fully comprehend.
We're in one hand clapping territory now.
Yeah. But I think there's like a really cool challenge there, right? To hear your own reaction in the sound that you're othering, and then to hear yourself in that sound. That's the kind of thing that I would love people to experiment with. I'm not telling them to take off their headphones forever.
But I it seems to me that there is a way to make sense of this in a concrete way, and it's how do you change the framing of something from noise toward sound, right? Because if it's noise, it's annoying and I don't want to hear it. If it's sound, maybe that's an invitation for me to open my ears, maybe open my mind to how receptive I'm being. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. I completely agree. There's this wonderful author named Jennifer Stover who talks about the sonic color line. And she's really talking about the way unacknowledged biases, unexamined ideas can inhabit our listening. And she talks about how racism can inhabit one's listening to other people's voices, to other people's sounds, to other people's music. And she sort of gives us a history of how white listening has been operating in this way historically.
Sonic color line, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's a really interesting book. Our implicit beliefs about how the world should sound, right? Like those implicit beliefs prevent us from encountering what's really there.
This project didn't begin with noise-canceling headphone technology for you. I found this fascinating. You set out to listen to a chanting machine in Taiwan. Take me through this. What is the chanting machine meant to do?
Oh, man, this is such a fascinating technology that I stumbled upon back when I was in my 20s. I lived in Taiwan for almost 4 years. I was, you know, teaching English and just sort of, I don't know, just being 20 years old. And but what I loved to do was, like, after work, I would walk all around the city of Taipei, just, you know, listening to the unfamiliar sounds, smelling the unfamiliar smells, and looking at the unfamiliar sights. And I would literally walk for hours. Well, one evening, actually, I was walking in this really older part of the city, and I was walking through an alley and I heard this monk chanting. So I started walking towards the voice through this maze of alleys. And I finally came to a house where the voice of the monk was obviously emanating from this room, but there was no monk in the room. And I was like super confused, and I didn't want to just stare in somebody's window too long. So I just kept walking and moved along. I asked a friend about it later, and they're like, oh, yeah, that's these machines. I'm going to butcher the tones of Chinese, but basically it's called a Nian Fuo Ji, which roughly translates to like a chanting Buddha machine. And so the chanting Buddha machine is used by Pure Land Buddhists to generate karmic merit. It's sort of like spinning a prayer wheel, you know? And so you don't have to chant yourself. You can actually have this little thing. It looks like a transistor radio. You just turn it on and it'll just chant these Buddhist sutras on a loop. And I was like, this is amazing. Like, I've never heard of anything like this. And I started collecting these little Buddha machines. And then much, much later, when I was in graduate school and I was studying, you know, cultural studies and media studies, and I knew I wanted to focus on sound, this idea of these Buddha machines came back to me. And I started to analyze, like, well, what exactly are these things doing? And what I intuited was that they were also creating a sense of space. They were also making people feel comfortable or meditative or relaxed, right? And then I started thinking about, well, what other kinds of things do that? And particularly, what things around us in the West do that sort of thing. And so it was through the Buddha machine example that I started to think about noise-canceling headphones, nature sound apps, white noise machines, all of which also sort of create a comfortable sense of space through sound, although in a much more secular manner.
Let's get back to this idea of the craving for silence. Do you think spirituality gets too much of a pass here? If I'm going on a retreat or to a temple or to a yoga center, is that kind of silence seen as being more legitimate than the silence I'm looking for when I'm out for a walk with noise-canceling headphones on?
That's a good question. I mean, I think we need to distinguish between actual silence and the sort of simulations of silence that my white noise machine provides, for example. There have been folks like the composer John Cage who have pointed out that silence doesn't really exist, right? But acknowledging that, I still think that there is a role for silence in contemplation. I mean, this is, you know, something that Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, Lao Tzu, like all of these people went into the wilderness or the desert or some quiet space to sort of develop these religious practices that people follow to this day, right? I do think, though, that that word practice is really important, you know, like a religious practice, going to a silent place. It's different to use that silence as an escape from the world and to use it as practice. I am practicing. And when I get finished with this practice in this silent space, I'm going to go out and practice in the noisy world again. And maybe I'll be a little bit stronger. Maybe I'll be a little bit more open. Maybe I'll be a little bit more engaged from having done that practice in this silent space.
So I now have the image of Jesus and the Buddha and Lao Tzu going into a state of contemplation or going into the desert, but they're not wearing noise-canceling headphones. They're finding a very different kind of silence. I mean, so do you think the issue here is silence itself or the way we're encouraged to seek out silence in the 21st century?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the first to say this, but we're in a sort of state a lot of the time where we're not really alone and we're not really with others, right? The MIT psychologist Sherry Turkle calls this state alone together. So we aren't really just sitting quietly alone with our thoughts or taking an unmediated walk in the woods by ourselves, but we're also not just engaged face-to-face socially with other people, but instead we're in this kind of pinging, lightweight contact of constant texting and looking at, you know, TikTok videos and checking out the news and what have you, right? So I think that can be really great, actually. You know, all of those things I mentioned can be great. So I don't want to denigrate them. There are all kinds of contact that happen through our media that are really valuable and wonderful. I just also think there are other kinds of contact, both with ourselves and with others, that we should keep those lines of communication open as well.
Is this an argument for just trying wherever we can to submit to the sonic environment? You know, is there something to be gained in just accepting a greater degree of noise?
I think of it as being experimental, living creatively with the sounds around you. Folks who study sound in this sort of cultural way that I do, sometimes the field is called sound studies. One of our practices is a sound walk, you know, where we just literally all just go for a walk in silence, maybe like 8 or 10 people. And usually there'll be a guide who has sort of a rough idea of where they want everyone to walk. They think there's some interesting sounds or maybe some not interesting sounds. And you actually just walk around and just experience what's around you. I'm always a little nervous before I take my students on one of these because I'm afraid they'll think it's completely absurd. And maybe it is, but you know what? Like, they love it. They're so refreshed by it. And it's a connection. It's a connection to what's actually around you.
My name is Samir Chabra with Tapestry, out on the streets of Toronto asking people wearing headphones, how often are you plugged in?
Probably like every day for hours.
Basically all the time, essentially, just to like tune out all the nonsense going around me.
90% of the time.
Probably all the time.
Almost 80% of the time.
Every time I'm not talking to somebody, I'm listening to music.
All the time, mandatory. I'd say it's a necessity.
What are you trying to tune out?
It's not that I'm trying to tune out anything. It's just, you know, it's how my day goes. I want to listen to my music. I want to be in my own vibe. You know what I mean? Unless I'm obviously with people, but if I'm by myself doing my thing at the mall, you know, I'm always going to have headphones in.
Music is kind of therapeutic for me, so it sort of grounds me when I'm listening to it. And what I'm trying to tune out is sort of all the negativity around me.
Usually I'm just listening to podcasts mostly to quiet the noise in my brain.
I think some people, when they wear headphones, don't want to hear their own voice, their own problem, like the responsibilities that you need. And they just wear headphones to not think about it and do something else, like run away from problems.
It's an excuse to not talk to someone. Like if I didn't want to talk to you, just pretend like I can't listen, can't hear you, and just walk away. So just, it's like a mask. It just covers you from the world, basically.
Are you ever worried about missing out on life around you?
Quite possibly, but that's why I'm always observant. So, like, I'm constantly looking around and, like, observing the areas around me. Like, even though I can't really hear anything, I'm still kind of, like, always have my eyes going to see if there's anything cool going on, and then I'll take my headphones out, just like what happened right now.
If there's something happening outside, sure, I pull my earphones off if it catches my attention, but for other times I'm in my zone. I don't really need to pay attention to what's happening around me necessarily.
No, but I probably should be. I do make an effort if I'm in a natural area to take out the headphones and just enjoy the nature.
Nah, what is there to miss out on? I mean, I'm just trying to get some eats right now. To be honest, I'd be worried about missing out on my music, to be honest.
That was my colleague Samir Chhabra piercing everyone's bubble of solitude in downtown Toronto. Now back to my conversation with Mac Haygood, who studies sound and what it means when we block it out. I love this line of yours that sound is a form of community. What do you think it is about sound that can bind people together?
Well, sound, you know, it's a way that people resonate together. If you've ever been to a church and everyone's singing, or if you've ever danced to house music or gone to a rock concert, right? I mean, these are ways that people come together, feel this sense of community, this sort of ecstasy together through sound. Music is remarkable about this. And actually, Orpheus was not only this person who controlled the sirens through the technology of his harp, but, you know, he was also sort of like said to be the first poet and the first singer of songs about the gods, and such an expert listener that he could hear the spiders spinning their webs. And so he was a great symbol of people coming together and human and non-human coming together and the gods and humans coming together through sound.
I hadn't realized that the original Walkman was designed with two headphone jacks, not the one that became popular in later iterations of this. What was the idea there?
Well, the designers at Sony in Japan literally thought nobody would be comfortable listening to music in public by themselves. It just seemed too antisocial. So they had two headphone jacks on the Walkman. And of course, you know, no one used the second one. And so they ended up taking it off. So it's just a little bit of a reminder of how much the world has changed between then and now.
Let's circle back to the noise canceling phenomenon just as we wrap up here. Does this technology just keep getting better and better? I mean, where does it go from here?
Yeah, I mean, the dream is, and there are people in the technology world who are working on this sort of thing, the actual devices that we put in our ears are getting smaller and smaller. But also, the earbuds that we wear increasingly are computers themselves. So there are computer chips inside of many of the earbuds that we wear today. So this kind of control of what the noise cancellation does, the dream for some folks in this space is to be able to selectively eliminate particular sounds, to customize listening. And so there's this dream of like never hearing a crying baby on a plane again. And that, you know, I don't want to, again, like catastrophize this, but it does worry me that if we are all just constantly wearing tiny little things in our ears that are barely even perceptible and we can block out anything we don't ever want to hear, there's that opportunity cost again, right? That way of engaging with our world as consumers rather than listeners.
And I'm thinking of the crying baby and a sound that is quintessentially human, right? I mean, you're then blocking off a sound that's very much part and parcel of being human.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And why are our ears so sensitive to the crying baby? I mean, you know, I think that's an evolutionary thing, right? Like, we need to be able to hear a crying baby. And that is a kind of empathy that we don't want, right? Like, why does the crying baby upset us so much? It's an upsetting sound, you know?
Which is meant to gain our attention so the baby can get what the baby needs.
Exactly.
Right? So I want to, you know, take advantage of the fact that I have someone here whose field is sound studies, because whenever I see etiquette advice around headphones, when should you take them off? When can you leave them on? It's coming from someone whose professional field is good manners. I have not been able to pose that question to someone whose field is sound studies. Do you have any guidance on when are they on, when are they off, when you're face to face with another human being?
Oh, boy. I mean, I worry that I've already been too prescriptive. I mean, I don't want to be the Miss Manners of headphones, but I would say that, you know, again, I like to think of it as an experiment. Could you play with taking them off in situations where you might just sort of preemptively put them on, right? Could you experiment with, in a socially awkward situation, getting a little bit of practice and just like saying hi to someone instead of having your headphones on? I mean, these are things that my students tell me they feel out of practice, you know, with, that they just haven't worked on it enough. And these are things that maybe folks of like the baby boomer age never even had to think of as a skill, because it was just what you did. You didn't really have any options, right? And as time has gone on and this control has been more in hand for us, it starts to have to be a conscious choice to get out of your media bubble and actually talk to other people and let those chance occurrences happen. And so I would say just experiment and play around with that, and maybe some happy accidents will happen.
Mac Haygood, really good to talk to you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Mac Haygood is assistant chair and associate professor of media and communication at Miami University, which is in Oxford, Ohio. Mac Haygood is the author of the book Hush, Media and Sonic Self-Control. And he's the host of Phantom Power, a podcast all about sound in life, theory, art, and music. Mac Haygood spoke to you from Cincinnati. This is Tapestry, keeping you company and helping you make sense of the world. If you're listening online at cbc.ca, hello to you. You can also find us on the CBC Listen app, on Spotify, on Sirius XM satellite radio, and on CBC Radio 1. I'm Mary Hines. Imagine leaving your home, your family, your community to train as a Buddhist monk, a whole ocean away. Brother Faphu is a monk in the Plum Village tradition who lives in France. He was taught by the Vietnamese peace activist and monk Thich Nhat Hanh, also serving as his personal attendant for years.
Hi, my birth name is Niem Nguyen, but I go by Brother Faphu because I'm a Buddhist monk in the tradition of Plum Village, student of Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh. So everyone knows me by Brother Faphu. My family is Buddhist, and most families from Vietnam are Buddhist. But in the Buddhist world itself, there's just so many different traditions and practices. And I start off with knowing more about a traditional style religion of like worshiping. And that for me was a little bit not my cup of tea. Growing up in Mississauga, I always had questions, and that's what we're taught in school, to ask things we don't know. But in 1990, Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh and one of his students, Sister Chang Kam, came to Toronto to give a public talk. And that was by chance when my father first met this Zen master, and he went to the public talk and he felt so moved. And I think deep down inside him, he realized that he needed some spiritual practice for his own healing of suffering that he went through from the Vietnam War, as well as being a refugee, a boat person. And so he ventured to Plum Village, which is in France. And after a retreat, he started to have his own personal transformation. And in 1996 was when he brought my sister and I to Plum Village for the first time. And this was the first time I met a community where I felt so aligned. The first interaction was a young monk and nun. And my idea of Buddhism was like, especially monastic, you are old or you suffer or you're very like with introverted and you don't want to communicate to the world. And that's why you become a monk or a nun in the Buddhist tradition. And this was the first time I saw something very different. Monastics who were very young, who spoke my language, not English, but spoke the modern language, and I can relate to. And this was when I started to understand Buddhism much more differently, as well as in Plum Village, Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh teaches about engaged Buddhism, and mindfulness is the foundation. So I started to understand much more that Buddhism is not about worship. It's not about wishing for a better future or wishing for a pure land of the Buddha, which is equivalent to the kingdom of God in Christianity. But it's more about how do we take care of ourselves in the present moment. Growing up in Mississauga, I was an immigrant. So I think the complexes of like, who am I really? Because outside I am a Vietnamese person with yellow skin, and internally, like everyone around me, the images of success were mostly dominated by Western people, white people. So my own idea is like, how do I become like that? And without knowing, this created a gap in my heart. And it pushed me away of my own roots, my heritage, which is Buddhism. So I particularly think that I just wanted to distance myself as much as I can away from what was nourishing for my ancestors' heritage. And I was looking for something outside of me. So I think that was something that I had to deal with. And so coming to Plum Village, speaking to monks and nuns who are of Vietnamese origin, but who comes from North America or come from Europe, I started to see, oh, if they can find happiness in their own skin, I know that that's possible for myself also. And then Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh was a Vietnamese person also. So I started to see someone who is Vietnamese, who has done something so profound for his community and the world. He was very courageous in calling for peace during the Vietnam War. And suddenly I started to go back inwards and just to identify who I am. And that is essentially Buddhism, is learning to come back inside of ourselves to understand ourselves more, our inner journey. So I started training when I was 13 years old. I did stay in Plum Village because it's so important to be in the right environment. And Plum Village is the environment for monastic training. I was only 13, so I was like a sponge and I just soak up society. So if I was, you know, back in high school by then, I don't think I could have kept that aspiration alive. So by now, it's my fourth retreat in Plum Village. And we used to come every summer, so it's like our summer vacation. And my dad and my sister was very supportive because they have been in Plum Village. But my mother, I think as a mother, to know your 13-year-old son would be so far away, it's a big sacrifice, and it's the unknown. So actually in year 2000, when I was 12, I already wanted to become a monk, but my mother said no, and I went home. And I didn't even dare to think about that when I was at home. But when in 2001, being back in Plum Village for just 2 weeks, I just realized what it meant for me to join this path. And that was really my pure joy and happiness. And I called my mother and I asked, "Mom, I really want to stay and become a monk. What do you think?" And there was this silence. And I was, you know, in my own mind, I was, okay, it's probably going to be a no. But then my mother just said yes. And I was so surprised. And I said, "Mom, like, do you know what that means? That means, like, I'm not coming back to Mississauga. I'm not coming back to Canada." And my mother said, "If that's what really makes you happy, I will support you, because any mother wants to support their child's happiness." So that was the real key in allowing myself to become a monastic. And this started to shift my whole relationship with my family. You know, my mother started to become vegetarian without me persuading at all. And 1 year, my mother came to visit me in Plum Village, France, and we always have an opportunity to have tea with our teacher, Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh. Thai means teacher in Vietnamese. That's how we refer to Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh. Thai asked my mother, "What have you seen change in your son, and what has changed in you?" And first of all, my mother said, "Well, I see that my child is still very happy, and that makes my heart blossom with joy. And what has changed in me is that knowing that my son is a monk, every action I do, I want to support him. So the way I dress changes, the way I communicate changes." So by me being a monk started to shift indirectly my whole family. This was not my intention, but we call this in Buddhism interconnectedness, or the word our teacher came up with is interbeing, which is like we're all supporting each other and every action has an impact to each other.
Brother Phap Hu is a Buddhist monk in the Plum Village tradition. He's also the co-host of the Plum Village podcast, The Way Out is In. You can hear more from Brother Phap Hu at the website cbc.ca/tapestry. He talks about his memories of working alongside his teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, and shares a few thoughts about the future of Plum Village after the leader's death. That's it for us this week. This episode was produced by Samir Chabra, Theo Van Buzekom, and Arman Egbali. Technical production by Laura Antonelli, with Marco Luciano and Will Yar. The senior producer is Rosie Fernandez. I'm Mary Hines. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.